Early this century, Cambridge housed a number of remarkable philosophers. The names, at least, of Bertrand Russell, Ludwig Wittgenstein, and G.E. Moore are public knowledge, as, of course, is that of John Maynard Keynes, who, though mostly an economist, knew them all and himself wrote a major philosophical work on probability. But the finest of all these Cambridge thinkers, Frank Ramsey, is hardly known to the public at all. My object in this programme is to try and begin to put that right. Frank Ramsey was only 26 when he died, in 1930. Yet in his short life, he produced most profound and original work in economics, mathematics, and logic, as well as in philosophy. Work that is still, nearly half a century later, immensely, indeed increasingly, influential. He was, as they say, a philosopher's philosopher. And likewise in mathematics, logic, and economics, he wrote for those who knew their subject. His work was not done for the layman, any more than Keynes or Wittgenstein's was. But their names, and something of their ideas, are known nonetheless. And so should Ramsay's be. Ramsay's was a distinguished family. His father was a senior don at Magdalen College, Cambridge, and his brother Michael went on to become Archbishop of Canterbury. Even so, young Frank stood out, as Lord Ramsay recalls.
As teenagers, though we were at different schools, in holiday times we saw a great deal of each other, playing together, just us two, and talking a great deal. I had great many conversations with him in teenage about all sorts of things. He was interested in almost everything. He was immensely widely read in English literature. He was enjoying classics, though he was on the verge of plunging into being a mathematical specialist. He was very interested in politics and well informed. He had got a political concern and a sort of left-wing, caring for the underdog kind of outlook about politics. I was aware that he was far cleverer than I was and knew much more, but yet there was such a total lack of uppishness about him that we just conversed in a friendly way, and he never made me feel inferior, though I was so vastly below par intellectually, and that was the wonderful joy of it.
Young Frank impressed Cambridge academics too, even before he became a student at Trinity College in 1920. His home was in Cambridge, and through his father he met in particular two fellows of Magdalen College, C.K. Ogden and I.A. Richards, who had wide interests in what were then called the moral sciences. Professor Richards remembers their rather curious first meeting with Ramsay.
Well, my old friend C.K. Ogden had a very queer place called Top Hole, named after a war cartoon, above McFisheries in Petticoat. And one afternoon there, tap on the door, and in came this tall, ungainly, rather gangling boy. We knew who he was instantly. He looked so like his mother. And in no time, almost, he was at home. And we chatted along for some time. And then he turned to Ogden and said, "You know, I've been thinking I ought to learn German. How do you learn German?" Now Ogden leapt up instantly, rushed to the shelf, got him a very thorough German grammar and a dictionary, Anglo-German dictionary, and then hunted on the shelves and found a very abstruse work in German, Marx's Analysis of Sensations, and said, "You're obviously interested in this, and all you do is to read the book, that's all. Use the grammar and use the dictionary and still come and tell us what you think." Well, believe it or not, within 10 days, Frank was back saying that Mark had misstated this and that he ought to develop that argument more fully. It wasn't satisfactory. He'd learnt to read German, not speak it, but to read it in almost hardly over a week.
Marx was not the last abstruse work Ramsay had to exercise his German on. During the First World War, Wittgenstein had written his early metaphysical masterpiece, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. He wrote it in German, and in a peculiarly condensed style. Ogden wanted an English translation, but getting one which would do justice to the original was no easy matter, as Professor Richards recalls.
Well, he'd had a very hard time with the Tractatus, and all sorts of people were called in and didn't like any version they could make of it. They couldn't make it make as good sense in English as if it made any good sense in German. They thought it should. Moore had been insisting very much that it wasn't translatable, to be much better left just as it was. After inventing the title, Moore's title, one way and another, it got into a kind of discard. And then I don't know who suggested that Frank ought to have a try at it. And as soon as Frank and Wittgenstein got together over this, it was clear that there was a possibility.
Wittgenstein's work impressed Ramsay enormously. He, like everyone else, found it exceedingly difficult, and he took immense trouble to try and understand it. In the autumn of 1923, after graduating, with first-class honours indeed, as the university's top student in mathematics, Ramsay went to Austria to visit Wittgenstein, who was then living in a small village outside Vienna. In a letter home, Ramsay gives a vivid picture of Wittgenstein's life and of the intensity of their conversations.
Wittgenstein is a teacher in the village school. He is very poor, at least he lives very economically. He has one tiny room, whitewashed, containing a bed, washstand, small table, and one hard chair. And that's all there's room for. His evening meal, which I shared last night, is rather unpleasant, coarse bread, butter, and cocoa. His school hours are 8 to 12 or 1, and he seems to be free all the afternoon. He's prepared to give 4 or 5 hours a day to explaining his book. I've had 2 days and got through 7 out of 80 pages. He has already answered my chief difficulty, which I have puzzled over for a year and given up in despair myself and decided he had not seen. It's terrible when he says, "Is that clear?" And I say, "No." And he says, "Damn, it's horrid to go through all that again."
Professionally, Ramsay had a particular reason for being interested in the ideas of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. He was, after all, a mathematician. And amongst his earliest philosophical interests, naturally, was mathematics itself, how mathematics differs from other subjects, and in particular, what makes mathematical truths true. There are various answers to these questions. Bertrand Russell had recently said that mathematics is simply an elaboration of logic, that logic is what makes it true. He and his colleague, A.N. Whitehead, had tried to prove this in their monumental Principia Mathematica by deriving the whole of mathematics from purely logical principles. By the early 1920s, however, this conception of maths as logic had run into serious difficulties. At the root of these, Ramsay thought, was Russell's treatment of it as consisting of propositions statable in purely logical terms, or, as Ramsay put it, completely general propositions, not about particular things and relations, but about some or all things and relations. But, Ramsay continued,
it's really obvious that not all such propositions are propositions of mathematics or logic. Take, for example, any two things differ in at least 30 ways. This is a completely general proposition, and it may well be true. But as a mathematical or logical truth, no one could regard it. It's utterly different from any two things together with any other two things make 4 things, which is a logical and not merely an empirical truth.
But what then is a logical truth? Principia Mathematica doesn't say. Wittgenstein's Tractatus does. It's a tautology. That is, roughly, a proposition which turns out true, however any other proposition may turn out. Now, not all tautologies are mathematical. either it's raining or it's not, is a tautology. It turns out true, whatever the weather. But it isn't mathematical, because it isn't general enough. Any two things differ in at least 30 ways, on the other hand, is general enough. It isn't maths, because it isn't a tautology. Mathematical propositions, Ramsay said, must be both. Propositions that are completely general in content and tautological in form. This famous paper of Ramsay's on the foundations of mathematics was read to the London Mathematical Society in 1925, when Ramsay was 22. The way in which, like most of his papers, it took off from the work of other philosophers illustrates something important both about Ramsay and about philosophy. Ramsay's friend and contemporary, Richard Braithwaite, now an emeritus professor of philosophy at Cambridge, reacted rather strongly when I incautiously contrasted Ramsay and Russell in this matter of originality.
You're entirely wrong. Russell started completely from his curiosity about the foundations of mechanics, which is doubtless Mach. Russell went on from this. I think you've got it completely wrong. Look here, Ramsay was not the creative beat artist. He was not a free expressionist of the slightest. Certainly not. I really protest at your notion of what originality in a subject like philosophy consists in. It doesn't start in having original ideas ab initio. What it consists in is thinking of something which is an improvement on previous thinking. This is what Ramsay did in great numbers of spheres.
Another sphere in which Ramsay notably improved on previous thinking was probability. John Maynard Keynes, to whom Richard Braithwaite introduced Ramsay in 1921, published his treatise on probability in August of that year. In it, he put forward a theory of probability that was a notable advance on the standard theories of his time, and has had much influence ever since. It didn't satisfy Ramsay. His criticisms of it, some of them published before he was 19, were so cogent and comprehensive that Keynes himself abandoned it. Ramsay, of course, criticised Keynes, not for the sake of criticising, but in order to arrive at a better theory still. Ramsay's theory is in a 1926 paper on truth and probability. Here, he starts from the idea of people's activities being determined, on the one hand by what they want, and on the other by what they expect to happen. The measure of what people expect is the probability they attach to things. When the Met man says it will probably rain, he means he expects rain more than he expects sun. But what he, or anyone else, does as a result of this expectation, for example, whether he takes an umbrella with him when he goes out, depends also on what he wants, for example, on whether and how much he wants to avoid getting wet. That is, in the economist's terms, on the utility that he attaches to keeping dry. Utility measures people's wants, just as probability measures their expectations. The problem is how to separate these two components of people's actions. A man rushes out of doors bareheaded. Is it that he wants to stay dry but expects sun? Or is it that he expects rain but for some reason wants to get wet? What Ramsay did was to devise a way of disentangling wants and expectations, utilities and probabilities, from how people behave. And in so doing, he laid foundations for the serious use of these notions in economics and statistics as well as in philosophy. It took a long time, however, for Ramsay's work in 1926 to bear fruit. Not until the publication in 1945 of a famous American book on the theory of games and economic behaviour did utility theory begin to catch on and to be applied in decision theory, in games theory. During the next 10 years, games theory became very much an in thing, from the Pentagon's war games on down, or up. And not for years was it realised how much of all this was already in Ramsay's 1926 article. And as with utility, so with probability. As Professor Richard Jeffrey of the Philosophy Department at Princeton University recalls.
It was when Leonard Savage, a statistician, was working on his book on subjective probability theory, and he wished to find out what, if anything, the philosophers had to say on the subject. He went to the Ramsey article and read it, and he found that what he had done was, to a great extent, fairly describable as rediscovering another aspect of Ramsey's work in that article. It was Savage's book, published in 1954, that made subjectivism a respectable sort of doctrine for a serious statistician to maintain. And the remarkable thing is that Ramsey had done all of that already, but somehow he wasn't speaking to the right audience, or the audience wasn't prepared or something, but it was only some time later that his ideas were rediscovered by people to whom the learned were attuned somehow or other.
Why Ramsey's ideas weren't picked up in Cambridge at the time, in the 1920s and 30s, isn't very clear. Professor Braithwaite takes part of the blame.
Now, with regard to why his notions, views of probability didn't get more, weren't accepted more, I'm sorry, I think I have myself to blame to a certain extent, because I edited the works, and I thought they were very interesting. But at that moment, this was the moment when Wittgenstein had descended on Cambridge, and all of us in Cambridge took the next 10 years trying to digest Wittgenstein.
With the benefit of hindsight, I rather feel that Cambridge in the 30s, indeed the whole philosophical community, might have been at least as well employed trying to digest Ramsey. And indeed, that but for Ramsey's early death, Wittgenstein himself would have developed and been digested rather more critically and profitably than was in fact the case. One eminent Oxford observer who shares this view with me is Sir Alfred Eyre.
There is a good deal of evidence that Wittgenstein had a respect for Ramsey's opinion, and that Ramsey didn't follow Wittgenstein whole. Now, I don't think that Wittgenstein's dominance in Cambridge in the 30s was at all a healthy thing for Cambridge philosophy, as you know yourself. Moore was some curious way, and I think in his modesty, in a way, felt himself not equipped to take issue with Wittgenstein. I think Ramsey would have done this and would perhaps have stopped Wittgenstein from going in a direction that I've never thought at all a happy one.
Of course, Wittgenstein's influence was not the only, nor even the main reason why so much of Ramsey's work, not only his work on probability, was neglected or underestimated for so long. The plainness and what Maynard Keynes called the easy grace of Ramsey's writing is apt to conceal at first the depth, originality and precision of his thought. He makes it all look so light and easy, until you try to think through the matter yourself. It's not surprising that he had less immediate influence than Wittgenstein. The German original of Wittgenstein's "What we cannot speak about, we must consign to silence," positively reeks of profundity. Ramsey's "What we can't say, and we can't whistle it either," sounds much less impressive, although in fact it sums up a profound objection to the whole of Wittgenstein's Tractatus. But the main reason it has taken so long for Ramsey to be properly taken up is just that his work was so original and so hard, and he himself was so unassertive. As I.A. Richards put it,
"It may have been a bit difficult for most people, even in his own new fields. It's the newer fields, I think, that have become so recognised. That might be it. And the other thing is, of course, he never was a showman at all. Not the faintest trace of trying to make a figure of himself. Very modest, gentle. And on the whole, he refrained almost entirely from argumentative controversy. Very interesting. He wasn't a controversialist at all. He felt too clear in his own mind, I think, to want to refute other people."
That's an impression Professor Braithwaite confirms.
"He didn't dominate conversations. He tended not to take the initiative. But if, of course, he was asked his opinion on something, he would then speak in a paragraph or a few paragraphs. If he had something to say, he would go on about it."
It would be quite wrong, however, to give the impression that Ramsey went on only about his work. that he achieved his extraordinary output by devoting himself full-time to, well, to philosophy, economics, mathematics, logic, and anything else his friends needed sorting out. Far from it, as his wife, Mrs. Lettice Ramsay, recalls.
He never worked for long hours. I think the work was so exacting that I wouldn't have said he worked for more than, say, 4 hours a day.
But he didn't have a special regime of work?
No, I don't think so. I would have said that he worked in the mornings, probably went for walks in the afternoon, played the gramophone in the evening. Something of that sort.
Music was one of Ramsay's main interests, in fact.
Oh, he was immensely keen about music. He'd come on music, I think, fairly late, in his late teens or early 20s, and he was very, very keen. He spent a lot of time listening to records. And of course, records in those days were not nearly as good as they are now, but so always great efforts were made to get a better gramophone and a better sound box and all that. But he spent a lot of time on classical music and was very interested in Wagner and going to concerts too. We both went. Well, I'm very interested in music too, but not as keen as Frank used to be. We went to the Wagner Opera in London, but concerts in Cambridge.
Although Mrs. Ramsay had studied philosophy as an undergraduate, she had turned to psychology by the time she married Frank in September 1925, and they didn't discuss their work with each other much. What they did do was go hill walking.
We went several lovely holidays. We went to the Pyrenees once and walked over onto the Spanish side and got lost. Then we had to cross back into France and struck a snowstorm and really would have got lost if we hadn't been taken in by miners. They popped us into the beds of the night shift where we thawed out and then conducted us over the frontier the next day. So we really had some very splendid walking holidays. Walking from place to place, not staying in one place. We never went up any very high mountains. It was mountain walking rather than climbing. He was very afraid of heights, so that if we went to any place where there was a height, I had to hold his hand and lead him over the bad places.
Ramsay's head for heights must have got worse. Professor Richards remembers an earlier excursion.
Well, he hadn't been and clambered about rocks ever, and he was kind enough to say he'd come and spend about a week in North Wales in midwinter, icy weather too, not good weather at all. And we got along very, very nicely, did several quite decent climbs with... I'd feel when I had him on the rope that I had to make quite sure I got a very solid belay, because he was not quite built for climbing, and he'd be heavy in a fall, but he never fell off. It was all right. We got along very well. And he enjoyed it so much, you see, that was the point. Seemed to take a liking to it, but he never would have made a climber, no.
Walking, music, theatre, conversation with his friends.
He was a very easygoing, very natural person, extremely natural. I mean, no inhibitions, and very unshy of any ordinary sort of things. I mean, as people are now, much more than perhaps they used to be. Very untidy, didn't care a hoot about what he wore, what he looked like, had very untidy, rather poor hair, was a tall man. He was 6'3" and bulky. Now, I wouldn't have said fat, but weighed 16 stone or so.
His head was of a shape which is, I think, rather rare. He had a large head, and it was pentagonal. And the point, the chin being the point. He was rather short-sighted and wore spectacles, steel-rimmed spectacles in those days. His movements appeared to be rather clumsy, but as a matter of fact, he was quite a good lawn tennis player. And when he became interested in music, he was extremely adept at changing gramophone records. But he gave an impression to start with of clumsiness and that he would knock over furniture in a room. He didn't, as a matter of fact. A very loud laugh, which was infectious.
Ramsay's good humour and tolerance could surmount quite profound differences on matters which he took very seriously, like religion.
He was a militant atheist. Definitely. I mean, we were married in a registry office, wouldn't have dreamt of being married in a church, and he was really quite a militant atheist, not an agnostic, he was an atheist.
How did he get on with his brother?
Oh, I think on very friendly terms, even though their outlook was so different.
He dropped religion, rejected it as an unsound and irrelevant occupation, and did move right away from it. He was certainly sorry that I went on being religious. He was sorry that I decided to become a priest in the Church of England. Sorry indeed, but quite tolerant. In the last year or two of his life, it came through to me that while his non-religious attitude in general remained, he was aware of mysticism as a kind of phenomenon worth studying empirically. And we had one, even right up to his last illness, we had one or two talks about that, and I was struck by this readiness to respect mysticism as an empirical phenomenon.
Nor indeed were Ramsay's friends offended by his criticisms of their ideas. For example, though Ramsay demolished Keynes' theory of probability, that didn't deter Keynes from encouraging his own college, King's, to offer Ramsay a fellowship in 1924, at the ripe age of 21. Ramsay began to lecture on the foundations of mathematics for the university's mathematics faculty, and in 1926 he was appointed a university lecturer in mathematics, the job he held until his death 4 years later. Given that he was a lecturer in the subject, it's curious that on mathematics itself, as opposed to its philosophical foundations, Ramsay only published 8 pages, and those 8 pages have since had an even more curious history, as Professor Jeffrey explains.
In the course of solving a problem in formal logic, he thought that he needed to state and prove an abstract mathematical theorem, so he did. In point of fact, that theorem wasn't needed to solve the problem, but it's fortunate that he thought it was, because it was an extremely interesting theorem, and there's a small industry in, among professional mathematicians these days of pushing Ramsay's theorem and trying to extend it into new areas. There is a thing that mathematicians will recognize by name, the name being Ramsay's theorem, and it's something that people are still working at.
While the logical problem that Ramsay used his theorem to solve a special case of was shown the year after he died to have no general solution, and there is no longer the point that Ramsay thought there was in trying to solve it. So Ramsay's enduring fame in mathematics, which was his job, rests on a theorem he didn't need in trying to do something we now know can't be done. Maynard Keynes did more for Ramsay than get him a fellowship at King's College. He encouraged him to work on Keynes' own subject, economics. Ramsay's interest in economics, in fact, went back to his school days, and C.K. Ogden got him to study the then much-discussed social credit proposals of one Major Douglas. Professor Richards again recalls the upshot.
Soon after he'd done the Douglas credit thing, A.S. Ramsay, his father, called up Ogden and said, "What have you been doing to Frank?" And Ogden said, what's he been doing? "Oh, he's written a paper, on Douglas credit, which would have won him a fellowship in any university anywhere in the world instantly. It's a new branch of mathematics."
How old was he when he did that?
Oh, I think 18.
Perhaps his father was biased. But Keynes knew a good economist when he saw one, and here is what he had to say in his obituary notice of Ramsay.
"Economists living in Cambridge have been accustomed from his undergraduate days to try their theories on the keen edge of his critical and logical faculties. if he had followed the easier path of mere inclination, I'm not sure that he would not have exchanged the tormenting exercises of the foundations of thought, where the mind tries to catch its own tail, for the delightful paths of our own most agreeable branch of the moral sciences, in which theory and fact, intuitive imagination and practical judgment, are blended in a manner comfortable to the human intellect. When he did descend from his accustomed stony heights, he still lived without effort in a rarer atmosphere than most economists care to breathe, and handled the technical apparatus of our science with the easy grace of someone accustomed to something far more difficult. But he has left behind him in print only two witnesses to his power: his papers published in the Economic Journal on A Contribution to the Theory of Taxation in March 1927, and on A Mathematical Theory of Saving in December 1928. The latter of these is, I think, one of the most remarkable contributions to mathematical economics ever made. Both in respect of the intrinsic importance and difficulty of its subject, the power and elegance of the technical methods employed, and the clear purity of the illumination with which the writer's mind is felt by the reader to play about its subject. The article is terribly difficult reading for an economist, but it's not difficult to appreciate how scientific and aesthetic qualities are combined in it together.
This paper sets out to say how much of its income a nation should save, and gets a general and definite answer, albeit under highly simplifying assumptions. It isn't an easy paper, as Keynes remarked, but even non-economists can appreciate Ramsay's use for the ideal state in which all possible enjoyment can be had now, so that there's no need to save anything, of the technical term bliss. Not only in economics does one wish that writers could more often be so apt and witty in their choice of vocabulary. As in probability and mathematics, however, so in economics it took time for Ramsay's ideas to catch on. Only since 1960 have Ramsay's ideas on saving been much developed, and his ideas on taxation only since 1970. Now, however, as the introduction to the new edition of Ramsay's work puts it, they are generally recognised as the starting points of two flourishing branches of economics, optimal taxation and optimal accumulation. Of all the moral sciences, however, pure philosophy was what Professor Braithwaite aptly called Ramsay's vocation. To summarise all his philosophical work, let alone its subsequent, if again belated, influence and ramifications, would be quite impossible. Let me give just two examples to illustrate respectively the things that strike one again and again in Ramsay's writings, even in the sketchiest of his later unpublished notes, namely, his startling originality and profound simplicity of thought, and the extent to which he anticipates much later and more laborious literature. Take first Pilate's notorious question, "What is truth?" What does it mean to say that someone's belief is a true belief? That question is as old and as unsettled as anything in philosophy. Ramsay calmly suggests, in an aside to a paper on something else, that it's the wrong question. It is evident, he says, that "it is true that Caesar was murdered" means no more than that Caesar was murdered. And that, in essence, is all there is to truth. The concept of truth is redundant. To assert that something is true is just to reassert the thing itself. The real question is not what it is for my belief that Caesar was murdered to be true. That's easy. It's just for Caesar to have been murdered. But what it is to believe that Caesar was murdered, as opposed on the one hand to hoping, fearing, or having some other attitude to the matter, and on the other hand, to believing something else. But only recently have most philosophers stopped being scandalized by Ramsay's curt dismissal of Pilate's question and come to see that the real question is just what Ramsay says it is. Ramsay didn't get very far himself in answering his question of what distinguishes belief from other attitudes and one belief from another, or, in linguistic terms, what distinguishes the meaning of a sentence expressing a particular belief from the meaning of other sentences. His general approach was clear enough. Under the influence of Russell, and of the American philosopher C.S. Peirce, to whose work Ogden had introduced him, Ramsay took a pragmatic view of the matter, which he admitted to be very vague and undeveloped.
The essence of pragmatism I take to be this, that the meaning of a sentence is to be defined by reference to the actions to which asserting it would lead, or more vaguely still, by its possible causes and effects.
Thus, the meaning of the sentence, "The pub is open," is to be explained somehow in terms of such actions as my going there if I feel like a drink and believe that sentence to be true, that is, believe that the pub is open. Since Ramsay's death, this approach has been taken up by many other philosophers, and there's no doubt in my mind that it is far and away the most fruitful way of explaining what belief is and what sentences mean. My second example is Ramsay on scientific theories, and here he was even more prophetic. Professor Braithwaite explains the background.
Well, the problem arose because during the whole of the 19th century, physicists had been using more and more abstract concepts, electric potential, current, fields of force, and then even more recently, photons, electrons, and so on. What was the status of these things? What were they? In what did their reality consist? The tradition among the philosophers among whom Ramsay was brought up was to say that these things were to be defined in terms of the things which were once simply observed. Pointer readings, electric shocks, sparks, and so on. And this was the view which Ramsay came upon in first thinking about the problem. That he saw that this account of defining them in terms of observables would take away nearly all of the value of talking in terms of theoretical concepts. Because if this is so, theoretical concepts could only mean what they had already been used for explaining. And there would be no possibility of developing a science by making for more use, different, novel uses of theoretical concepts. Ramsay produced, therefore, a very interesting view of how to deal with, how to consider these theoretical concepts. In the Ramsay theory, these terms played their part in extremely complex sentences which had both them and observables in as well. So that a treatise of physics would really be one big, long sentence. It would be rather like a fairy story, starting, "Once upon a time there was a man who," or "Once upon a time there was a frog which," the rest of the story going on to say, describe the adventures of the man or the adventures of the frog. A book on electrons, for example, treatise on electrons, in Ramsay's view, starts by saying, "There are things which we call electrons, which," and then goes on with a story about the electrons. Well, this account of Ramsay's of science, in a form which were later called, 20 years later, called Ramsay's sentences, were that they were that the statements of science were all, there is something which, similar to there is in various stories, only of course you then believe the whole thing, the whole there is sentence, whereas in a fairy story, of course you don't.
One immediate consequence of Ramsay's view is that no single bit of a scientific theory can, as Ramsay said, be understood apart from the whole theory to which it belongs. And bits of rival theories can't be dismissed just because they don't occur in ours.
If a man says, "Zeus hurls thunderbolts," that is not nonsense because Zeus does not appear in my theory and is not definable in terms of my theory. I have to consider it as part of a theory and attend to its consequences. For example, that sacrifices will bring the thunderbolts to an end.
By the same token, if we want to work out whether some bit of a theory, like Zeus hurls thunderbolts, or electrons have such and such a mass, is true or not, we can't just assess it on its own.
We have to think what else we might be going to add to our theory, or hoping to add, and consider whether it will be certain to suit any further additions.
Another thing that follows is that rival theories may give quite different meanings, even to theoretical concepts which they appear to have in common, as Newton and Einstein did to the concept of mass, so that there may be no straightforward way of comparing two such theories, not even of saying that they're incompatible with each other. As Ramsay put it,
"The adherents of two such theories could quite well dispute, although neither affirmed anything the other denied."
That all this is so, Ramsay took for granted. And his theory of what theories in science are shows immediately and elegantly why it should be so. But the subsequent generation of philosophers of science largely ignored these problems of comparing theories in science, and their rediscovery in the 1960s, through case studies in the history of science, was hailed as a new breakthrough in the subject. But in explaining why these problems arise and how they can be resolved, I'm afraid we've not got much further than Ramsay got in 1929. Had Ramsay lived, I have no doubt he would have taken the problem further and faster than we have done. But he didn't live. He contracted jaundice and died following an operation in Guy's Hospital in London on January the 19th, 1930. He was not quite 27 years old. As Professor Braithwaite wrote at the time, his death, at the height of his powers, deprived Cambridge of one of its intellectual glories and contemporary philosophy of one of its profoundest thinkers. The time it has taken the rest of us to catch up with and to develop Ramsay's ideas is some measure of what we have lost by his early death. How he himself would have gone on, we can only guess. Sir Alfred Eyre relates Ramsay to Professor Quine of Harvard, a comparison calculated to impress any professional philosopher.
Well, I think that these unfinished papers did seem to me to show enormous insights. I mean, I got the impression from reading them that here was a man who had a great number of fertile ideas and the ability to develop them, and those we lost. I would say that Ramsay might have become a sort of English Quine, and perhaps at least as gifted as Quine, in the sense that that's the kind of direction in which he would have taken English philosophy. And I do see in those papers some kind of hints of the kind of views that Quine much later developed.
Professor Braithwaite.
This paper on theories and these thinking about belief was what had been occupying him the last year of his life, and I think he would have gone on thinking about this. But in 1931, this extraordinary paper of Gödel's appeared, which caused a revolution in mathematical logic in establishing conclusively that no formal system which was rich enough to have an arithmetic in it could be shown to be self-consistent. Well, Gödel's paper really made mathematical logic into a professional subject and a specific and exciting branch of mathematics. I believe this would have excited Ramsay so much that he might have galloped down this for 10 years or so and left philosophy, but I do not know.
Professor Jeffrey agrees, up to a point.
It would be unlike Ramsay simply to go into metamathematics as pure mathematics. I think it would have stimulated some very interesting philosophical thinking from him, too. I think, though, you're right, Braithwaite's right, that Gödel's result is just the sort of thing that would have fascinated Ramsay, that he would have gobbled up and done some very important, interesting work in, I imagine, yeah. It's too bad he died just before that. And so that's just an example. He was also, of course, an accomplished economist. So, you know, he was a mathematician, economist, philosopher, logician. I mean, God knows where he would have wound up or what he would have done exactly. He was simply a terribly talented and lively mind.
Let Ramsay have the last word. In 1925, he gave to the so-called apostles, the distinguished, if somewhat furtive, Cambridge Discussion Society, a paper with the provoking thesis that there is really nothing to discuss. And apropos of Bertrand Russell's then recent disparaging remarks on the small size of men in relation to the universe, he concluded,
Where I seem to differ from some of my friends is in attaching little importance to physical size. I don't feel the least humble before the vastness of the heavens. The stars may be large, but they cannot think or love. And these are qualities which impress me far more than size does. I take no credit for weighing nearly 17 stone. My picture of the world is drawn in perspective, and not like a model to scale. The foreground is occupied by human beings, and the stars are all as small as threepenny bits. I don't really believe in astronomy, except as a complicated description of part of the course of human and possibly animal sensation. I apply my perspective not merely to space, but also to time. In time, the world will cool and everything will die. But that's a long time off, and its present value at compound discount is almost nothing. Nor is the present less valuable because the future will be blank. Humanity, which fills the foreground of my picture, I find interesting and, on the whole, admirable. I find, just now at least, the world a pleasant and exciting place. You may find it depressing. I am sorry for you, and you despise me. But I have reason, and you have none. You would only have a reason for despising me if your feeling corresponded to the fact in a way mine didn't. But neither can correspond to the fact. The fact is not in itself good or bad. It is just that it thrills me and depresses you. On the other hand, I pity you with reason, because it is pleasanter to be thrilled than to be depressed. And not merely pleasanter, but better, for all one's activities.